It's time to talk about the outdoors in South Alabama. Hunting, fishing, and getting outside along the Great Gulf Coast. It's time to take it outside with FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. With reports, stories, how-to information, and Dr. Bill's Marine Forecast. Here's Sean Sullivan and Mike Ward.
And away we go. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have y'all here. And good to see my friend back from assignment, Mike Ward. Good to see you.
Man, it was a great assignment.
Great assignment out in Kansas. We're going to get to that in just a second. Also, as we get started here, news that was breaking on Thursday. Here we go. Here we go again. NOAA has now closed amberjack fishing until September of 2026.
Isn't that crazy? I'm telling you, you cannot go fishing out there anywhere, especially around any kind of a decent-sized reef without catching amberjack.
There's it's because you caught too many. According to NOAA Marine Fisheries, the 2024-2025 recreational catch limit for amberjack was 478,451 pounds, more than the 404,000-pound annual limit, coming in at 882,451 pounds. In other words, we went over for amberjack out there.
And I don't know how they calculate that, but I don't think not that many people they are fishing right now. They just opened it the 1st of September, I think, somewhere
I don't know how we got that. I don't
Labor
know how we
Day,
beat.
Somewhere around that.
Yeah, when August, they, I think, late. Yeah,
yeah, it was when they opened it up. Now they've closed it, 30 days later or whatever. Yeah. There's not that many people fishing right now to start with.
I don't know. We're going to have to crunch these numbers, get somebody on in a further show to talk about this. So it is for the recreational side. Also, charter boats closed as well on amberjack. Yeah. So till September of 2026.
Crazy.
Before that opens. All right. And we're going to talk a lot of deer on today's show. And before we get our guest on, you're back from assignment in Kansas. What a buck.
Man, I'm telling you, my buddy Michael Durr from he lives up on Lake Martin. He killed a monster out there. It was opening, Monday weekend and a half, almost 2 weeks ago, opening day of muzzleloader season and bow season. He was muzzleloader hunting, and he killed a monster. 24-inch inside spread, 14 points, scored 181 and a half.
Wow.
He was an absolute monster. We seen him on camera. Went out there a month ahead and put cameras out and everything. Seen him on camera. He came out every night. And another nice one was coming out, but he was the biggest one. But never saw a daylight picture of him. All of them were nighttime. But my buddy Mike Durr decided he's going to go over there and hunt him anyway. And that deer came out about 30 minutes before dark. First time we ever seen him on camera. So we got a picture of him on the camera, 30 minutes before dark, and next thing you see is him, Michael Durr, walking out there and getting him. Unbelievable. Then Joe Chastain's been hunting a big one, probably going to score better than that one, and he was coming out every afternoon, 20, 30 minutes before dark, every day for a month, every day. Got to opening day of deer season, he didn't come out.
That's why he's bigger.
I mean, just crazy. He wouldn't come out before dark. And then he left for 2 or 3 days. And then he came back, but it was at dark. And he hunted him several days, but never got a chance to see him.
Well, that's a heck of a buck. And we'll talk more about that going forward when y'all go back up. Towards the right. I'm going to bring this man into the conversation, and I'm going to ask him the hard question here. He's been a guest with us in the past. He was deer coordinator for the state of Alabama. He's now in the private sector, the owner at CNC Wildlife and Forestry Consulting. Chris Cook, all I need to know is, can you make it so I can shoot bucks like Mike does in Kansas on my place in Mobile County? Can you help me, please?
I could help you. We may never get there, so it'll be I will help you, though.
If y'all remember, Chris, I mean, one of our most popular episodes over the years, Chris had come on and talk about the rut in Alabama. And, you know, we get this idea that the rut, there's two, you know, there's the January rut and the February. And then Chris pointed out that, well, there's a bunch of others in the state of Alabama. And we kind of broke down the timing in those ruts and maybe about restocking that went on. That's something, because we get this idea, if you don't travel, I guess if you don't leave where you hunt all the time, you think there's one or maybe two peak ruts in Alabama, but that's not true.
Yeah, it varies quite a bit. It's pretty consistent you know, in the southern, say below Highway 80, it's pretty consistent being, you know, the tail end of January and early February being the peak of breeding. But once you get above that point, it's very, very site specific in much of the state. So it's very odd. You're talking about hunting in Kansas and in most other states, it's not that way. But in Alabama, it's definitely a different scenario that a lot of hunters aren't accustomed to if they're not from Alabama.
You know, when you're a biologist like Chris, the two phrases I hear from y'all most. It depends and site specific.
Yeah, everything site specific.
But part of that, you know, we talk about the rut dates, and we're not going to take the whole time to talk about the rut. I will get you back closer to the rut, but like talk about an anomaly where I am in West Mobile County, my deer rut kind of like a deer in the black belt. It's a mid January peak for us there. You can go north of me, and it goes back to that later rut. You worked a lot on early on, didn't you, on the relocation or transplant of deer in Alabama?
Well, that was when I was in graduate school. The project I worked on was translocation of deer from Clark County up to Bankhead National Forest. And but you know, I have you know, looked at a lot of the historic restocking records around the state and you know, mapped all that out. It had been. All of that was in an old book that had, you know, that was put together by the state back in the 60s, late 60s, I think, maybe early 70s. And it had the number of deer, where they came from, and then a location. And the location may just be a county or it could be section township range. So I went through, tried to clean that up and map that out. So I got pretty familiar with where a lot of the deer were relocated, especially the handful from out of state. Which, you know, there was some deer from out of state used back in the heyday of the restocking in the 50s, 60s, but it was, and earlier, I guess it started in the 20s, but most of it was in the 50s and 60s, but people want to, especially when you have an earlier rut, people want to attribute it to earlier than normal, I should say, for Alabama. Mm-hmm. People want to attribute it to the restocking, which outside of the population at Bankhead and then a couple other spots and a couple of national forests in Alabama, most of those out-of-state sources were just a handful of deer, not enough to you know, really affect what's going on now. They got swamped out by the remnant deer that were probably still hanging on in those areas that eventually came back and was the primary source for repopulating these areas. But that handful of deer from Ohio, Wisconsin, you know, stuff like that, just they weren't enough to matter in the grand scheme of things.
Well, yeah, that's that biology lesson we can do on a future show. But, I mean, it's back when people said, well, if I get a great giant buck and turn him loose, then I'm going to have great giant bucks. And you go, yeah, but all those other deer got genetics too.
Yeah,
you
got to deal with. Breed with.
Yeah, and they've got the other genetics. I mean, but Bankhead, those deer, for, you know, people hadn't heard us talk before. They're going to rut like a deer in Kansas, right? I mean, they're going to be early November.
Their peak of breeding is towards probably a little bit later than like in Kansas, but it's still going to be towards the end of November around Thanksgiving. Probably is the peak of breeding. Then you have up in Chuckalaca, WMA, and which is part of Talladega National Forest up in Cleburne and Calhoun County. They were stocked with deer from North Carolina back in the 40s, and they have a pretty early rut where they're maybe a week later than Bankhead, right at the tail end of November, early December, and then Okmulgee Wildlife Management Area, which is in the other part of Talladega National Forest over here in Pale Bibb, Tuscaloosa, Perry counties. They're a little bit later than that. They're kind of middle of December, but they were restocked into an area that probably had a better source of deer, that, you know, those remnant populations. So they've kind of they've kind of been surrounded and not as you know, not as probably true to what the original stocking source would have been. But and then you know up at Chocolock, it's probably a combination of the stocking source and then also the Georgia effect. Georgia has that a lot earlier rut over near about their, I guess, their entire state, and that is kind of keeps that earlier stuff up there in that little section of Cleburne, Calhoun County, probably parts of Cherokee County too. But that, outside of those areas, you can't really.
Well, I mean, there's, you talk about the Georgia effect
stuff and say it's likely linked to the stocking source. Other than, you know, on the flip side, you look at the late stuff, the late breeding populations north of Highway 80, you can just about all of those, you can point to restocking records where they were stocked with deer from Clark County, Alabama. And they have those late January and some in early February breeding, you know, well north of what probably historically it would have, or would have been if they had been allowed to repopulate with those remnant populations, but they definitely wouldn't have come back as fast. But you know, hindsight is 2020, so
it makes it interesting. I mean, you know, I've said that before. I mean, if somebody was mobile, you could hit a couple ruts in the state and be at peak, you know, which is pretty cool stuff. And we're going to have you come back when we're closer to the rut, because there's even more to dig into on that and talk about, you know, if people never paid attention, they're, you know, in the middle of the summer, it seems like they're hunting hardhorn deer in Florida. So there's a lot to that, you know, why the rut happens when it does. When we come back, we continue our conversation with Chris Cook. We're going to talk about what he does now and consulting and how we can have more big deer on our property this year. Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, glad to have you all along. And good to get this man back on the show after these years. Chris Cook, he is the owner of CNC Wildlife and Forestry Consulting. And so I asked him, you know, when we went to the break, when we came back, Chris would just tell us how to have more big bucks. Maybe not like Kansas, but...
Yeah.
Chris, I appreciate you hanging on with us. Yeah, you do this now. You know, you had probably 30 years with the department.
Yeah, it was a little over 30 years. It was closer to 31, but 30 sounds just as good.
Well, but yeah, you get to obviously study deer a lot, and it's nice to have that if somebody's consulting you that has seen a deer or two at a property or two and managing. I mean, you did, I think last time we talked, you were doing the DMAP stuff also, for hunting clubs?
Yeah, I started primarily working with DMAP back in 95 when I moved to Demopolis with the department. And that continued to be a big part of my job. When you're talking about deer-related things in Alabama, that's, you know, a big part of it. Has been DMAP since it came on board in the early 80s, mid-80s. So worked with a lot of hunting clubs and properties, primarily in west central Alabama, you know, from 95 until I retired. And so got to see a lot of places, see how people were managing their properties, and you know, see some things that worked and better than others. And then, you know, a lot of situations where they're, especially when you're talking about hunting clubs that are leasing land, they're kind of at the mercy of the landowners as far as what they can do outside of controlling what they shoot or don't shoot. So
what is D-mapping? For people that don't know what D-mapping is, explain that.
It's the department, the Alabama Division of Wildlife and Freshwater Fisheries, has a program that is free nowadays. It used to charge, but it's the Deer Management Assistance Program. And what that is a program that allows hunting clubs and landowners that have an interest in managing deer on their property, want to get some input from a wildlife biologist, they can sign up for the program, and they're paired up with a one of the department's biologists, and the club or the landowner, they collect harvest data from the deer they kill, you know, the basic stuff, the sex, age, weight, antler measurements, things like that, and they provide that to their biologist, and the biologist uses that data in addition to information they glean from on-site visits with the cooperator, just, you know, to gather information on habitat potential for the site, and they use that to help them develop a management plan to get to where they want to go with their deer. Primarily, it's focused on the harvest size. The biggest probably benefit outside of the interaction with the biologist and you know the use of the data to make recommendations is the where needed the cooperators are provided a permit that allows them to shoot antlerless deer throughout the hunting season, which, you know, now it's that's pretty much every county except for a handful. You can shoot a doe every day, but the permit allows you to shoot as many each day as you need or as you can or want to until your quota is met. And your quota is established by the biologist according to what the management objective or management goals are. So, yeah. You know, if you two had a property where, you know, the recommendations were to kill, you know, 20 does per year and y'all had the opportunity where you two could kill all 20 of them in the first 2 days of gun season, then you could do that with the DMAP permit.
Right.
And so it adds a lot of flexibility. But that's basically what the program is. It's free, and it's available to any hunting club and landowner that's, you know, willing to jump through the hoops, which primarily is just collecting and submitting harvest data each year. So, they can contact the district office for the county where the property's in. So for you guys down in southwest Alabama, it'd be the office there at Spanish Fork. People hunting up in the Black Belt in west central Alabama would be the office there in Northport in Tuscaloosa County, District 3 office. And so just look at the Division of Wildlife and Fresh Water Fisheries website to get those contact numbers and go from there if you're interested in DMAP. But it's you know, it's a good program. Can be if you know, it requires input from both sides, you know, the cooperator and the biologist. You have to put a little effort into to what you're providing and what you're doing. So, but it has potential to help folks get where they want to go.
Chris, when you go to a property and try to help the club, mainly club, probably who you fool with, but to help them get bigger deer, what's the number one reason? I think I know the answer. What's the number one reason that they don't have big deer on their property that you see? First off, yeah. Right off the bat, what's the first thing you see?
Well, most of the time it's because they're shooting them before they had the chance to get.
Bingo, I won.
And then unfortunately, there's a lot of situations where they've done a pretty good job of passing bucks and letting them get to, say, 4-plus years old before they shoot them, but the habitat is terrible. And you know, like I mentioned, in some situations, a lot of situations, especially with hunt clubs, it's they're very limited in what they can do to
they improve are.
That. So the jump you can make just from protecting deer for those one or two extra years is tremendous in most situations, regardless of habitat quality. You know, a 5-year-old compared to a 3-year-old is typically there's no comparison. So if you can ever make that step, make that leap to letting deer get to that age before shooting them, then regardless of habitat quality, for that site, it's going to be a huge improvement
right.
in deer quality. That's a challenge when you've got more than one person involved in deciding.
That's exactly what I was getting ready to say.
That's probably the most challenging part of all of it is the people side of it, trying to get people to even. They don't necessarily have to agree on everything, but to agree on the big things and that can definitely be a challenge.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, looking at this too, I wonder how much now, you know, you're going to work with a landowner or a club to maximize that. I wonder how much of it is happening, I don't know, by default or not on purpose with when we change to $3 and antler restrictions. You know, how much of that ends up, you know, it's not like a real management plan like you would give, but like default, no. If we're improving. I mean, I think we're seeing some, yeah. I mean, it's site specific. I know I got a biologist on, but I think we're seeing some of that out there.
I think that it did make a difference. A lot of hunters, the people for the most part are law abiding, even deer hunters. And so
when they're not drinking.
Historically, yeah, most of them historically, if they would have killed, you know, 3 or 4 bucks in a season, now they likely are a little more selective in what they shoot because they know they have a finite number that they can legally shoot. They can't, you know, shoot one every day. So I think that by default it has improved stuff in a lot of places. And then a lot of hunt clubs, you know, they have a, you know, in the past it was, you know, well, I'm going to, the state says I can shoot one every day, I'm going to shoot one every day. And now they say, well, you know, the state says you can't shoot them. So that helps some of those clubs because now they have the state to say, well, you can't do that anymore.
Right.
So that helped them. But I think for the most part, it has improved probably the age structure of bucks on a lot of properties just by default, just by that regulation being there. But it's, you know, there's still plenty of folks that aren't going. It don't matter what the rules are, they're going to break them. So,
yeah, we can only talk to the folks that do it the right way.
Yeah.
But it's a tougher thing, judging age, and it's something I do with the guys that hunt with me. And not to saying I'm perfect, but getting an idea of, you know, like I've said before, I said, y'all, there's a 5 point that needs killing and an 8 point that doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, like it, I mean, that's kind of weird from back in the day. Like, oh, it's judging by the number of antler or number of tines. Now I'm like, oh, that 5 point, it needs killing. That's an old deer.
Yeah.
And that 8 point is a 3.5 year old deer needs to make it.
Yeah. And that's an ideal situation where you can say, all right, we're going to shoot 4 year old and older bucks, and that you don't have to give somebody an antler criteria.
Right. But that's hard. It's not, I mean, even for those of us that study it, right? I mean, not like professionals like you, but those of us, I mean, it's not always a perfect science.
No. Well, most people, they just haven't had the opportunity to see that many deer in those age classes to get a good eye. You know, they haven't developed that ability to age bucks just looking at things other than antlers. And it takes time, and there's a lot of age, you know, there's a lot of things on the from reputable sites on the internet where you can pick up some pretty good tips on how to do that. And there's, you know, there's a lot of things on the internet that you know, even for deer hunters that'll give you some very, very bad, faulty information.
No.
So gotta be careful. everybody with a Facebook or Instagram account or a YouTube channel or a podcast can give you all the information that you ever needed to know about deer, whether they're qualified or not.
So. This is why we like having apologists on talking about it. We're coming back. More with Chris Cook right here on FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Glad to have you all along. Sean Sullivan, Mike Ward, our guest Chris Cook, owner of CNC Wildlife and Forestry Consulting. And, of course, I went off on a side tangent during the break there. But, I mean, you're talking about, Chris, you're talking about getting, and we, the charts, and people can go, we'll talk about your Facebook page, they can check it out as well. But a chart, like, and I think a lot of charts will say a buck 5 year, when it, because that was interesting too, a chart that you had up, have up on your Facebook page, that deer gets to 5 years, and it doesn't make big jumps going in antler size from year 6 and year 7, right? It kind of topped out in that chart.
Yeah, that chart you're referencing is from Mississippi State, from data they've collected over years and years and years, looking at the percentage of potential that bucks express at certain ages as far as antler growth goes. And for the typical buck, they're gonna level out at like 5 years old as far as, you know, they're not gonna be any kind of significant jumps for the typical buck, but there's always the exceptions, and there's been other studies and other regions of the country that's shown that on some sites deer need to get to 7 years old before they start reaching that leveling off and peak of antler development. But it's one of those, you know, it depends and site specific. It's one of those many things. It really does depend on the site. Some areas, especially where maybe the habitat quality is better, deer may get a little bit more of their potential by 4 years old than I say a deer in poor quality habitat, or throw in the late birth dates too. Mm-hmm. That throws deer behind the eight ball too. It takes them a while to get caught up to where they should be if they've been born a month or 6 weeks earlier, because they're still trying to play catch up on skeletal and muscle development and don't have the luxury of putting much excess resources into antler growth until they're older than deer in other regions where the birth dates are more in line with the typical deer breeding dates across the country.
But let me ask this then. So with what you do with clients, let's say we got one of those places that deer, and it's a segue into what I want to talk about here, the remainder of the show, and that's habitat work. Could you take a property, maybe regionally? Now, regionally, this place is not, you know, where you get that deer maturing by five. Maybe it's six or seven. But you come in, and I'm sure we can talk about doe harvest, but also habitat and putting more food on the ground. Have you seen it in a case where you moved into a place and said, now we made it to where that deer is maxing out by five and not seven? I mean, geography doesn't change. You're in the same place, but you change the outcome.
Potentially you could. You know, a lot of that is, you know, the soils will dictate how much of quality browse, quality food can be produced. You know, you can produce the same types of things, but the volume that's going to be produced is going to be, a lot of times it'd be limited in soil quality. Doesn't necessarily mean it can't produce those same quality plants. And so you're still going to have that challenge mixed into the equation, but definitely should be. If you start getting a habitat tuned up, you're definitely going to see deer producing more or reaching more of their potential at an earlier age, or you should, you know. And that's that. Of course, you can do all that. Then we talk about the people management. You've got, always have neighbors to contend with too. So that's one of those things that you've got to, a lot of people can't get out of their mind, but you know, you can only do what you can do. And if you're going to tread over that, then it's not much that I can help you with. If you're going to continually wring your hands about what the neighbor's doing, you got to do what you're going to do and do everything you can to get where you want to go. And hopefully people will get on board as the results start improving, and they can see that, hey, if Sean's doing this and he's seeing this, then maybe we should try that as well. That's always the best, probably the best thing to get people to rethink how they're doing their management approach, and just to see actual results of neighbors or people they know.
Well, that helps because, you know, nowadays with all the cameras, you know, and the neighbors liking each other and talking to each other, if you show your neighbor, hey, this deer, boy, this is a really nice 3.5-year-old deer, I'm going to try to let him go for a couple more years, your neighbor's thinking, oh, you know, that deer comes over there, I might not better shoot him because my neighbor ain't going to like me anymore if I shoot this deer. He's already told me, you know, these 3.5 is going to let him live a couple more years. Where used to, we didn't have that. We didn't have pictures that we could show the neighbors and say, hey, I'm trying to let this one live a little bit more. If y'all would, let's all try to let him live another 2 years before we shoot him. And you know, people just get that in them and they say, well, I better not shoot that deer, you know. So that helps some. Instead of the neighbors not telling the neighbor that they've got one that's 3 years old that they want to let get to 5 years old, if they don't tell them, then their neighbors don't know, and then the neighbor shoots them and he's mad at them, you know. You need to tell them. You need to open up and show them pictures so that it would embarrass them if they did shoot it.
Well, in a lot of situations, they think the same of each other. You know, they one of them thinks this one's doing what they're accusing each other of doing the same thing when in reality neither one of them's doing it. So
they're
both trying to pass those deer and let them get older. And, but in their mind, you know, old Joe's shooting everyone across the line and Joe's thinking Fred's doing the same thing. In reality, neither one of them's doing it. So then they once they realize, hey, they kind of have the same mindset, then they get a little more at ease with letting things like that happen, and makes results a lot the results happen faster when everybody gets on board.
That's right. Well, if you can get with your neighbors and work together on it, it definitely is better.
Yeah, think about it. The landowners around me, we've kind of done that. But it takes a second to get out of that habit of, I'm not going to tell anybody about this deer. Well, unless you got the biggest of big spreads, the chance that deer's not going to stay on you all the time. I mean, just got to be real.
Well, if he's five years old and he's a shooter, may not want to tell your neighbor. You want to shoot him before anybody else sees him.
Yeah, but I mean, if you've got this gorgeous three-year-old on there.
Right.
The old mentality, I think, would have been like, I can't let anybody know about him.
Yeah, that's right. No, the opposite.
Yeah.
Let everybody know.
We got to get out of our normal comfort zone and do
that's
that.
Right.
You know, and thinking about habitat-wise, too, and we could talk food plots and all this, but and we can come back to it. But something you do that I really appreciate is you're doing managing for native browse. And as a guy that, you know, puts a lot of fire on the ground, that's what I'm trying to do. I have limited, I don't have black belt soil. I don't have row crops. I don't have, you know, those things. But the amount of food I'm putting on the ground with fire, and I know there's other management techniques, has got to bolster when we finally put our food plots in. I mean, I see you doing a lot of that for your clients. Did we lose you, Chris?
No, I had wired doctors out.
They must have saw a squirrel in the yard.
I don't know what. They sit here watching the road all day. Actually, I've been helping a couple friends of mine that have a lot better or a lot bigger client base than I do. But yeah, they've been doing a lot of burning throughout the year, and been doing a lot of growing season burn that I've been helping them with. But yeah, those kind of things, you know, it doesn't cost much, but it can greatly improve what's going on in some stands that aren't necessarily producing what they could, and it's just a matter of running the fire through it under the right conditions and getting a whole lot better response than of course not doing anything. And so yeah, that's very important. People, you know, they want to you know, with everything, it's what's the quickest and easiest route. Well, the quickest and easiest route and a lot of people's minds scratching out a food plot on 1% of their property and throwing some seed out instead of trying to do something on the 98% of the remaining ground, you know, where the deer are finding, you know, the bulk of what they're eating throughout the year. People want to focus on their food plots or what they're putting in a feeder.
Because I think we get blind to that, right, Chris? That we think if you're sitting in a shooting house watching a field, well, all the deer I see are feeding in this food plot. But you weren't watching them 12 months a year or all the other hours of the day when they're eating other stuff.
Or you weren't watching them while they were walking to that food plot or what they're going to do after they leave that food plot, which is feed on all those plants and those forbs and vines and everything else that they're depending on. in those forested stands or those old fields or fallow areas or that clear cut that you cussed about when the company you're leasing from cut the last hardwood off the site. But there's tons and tons and tons of forage out there that the deer are using 12 months out of the year instead of a few acorns that they ate for 2 or 3 months out of the year. So it all depends on what your objectives are and what you're really trying to achieve. If you're trying to really do everything you can and get the most out of what the place you're doing, then you're definitely going to have to start working on the habitat side of things.
Coming right back, more with Chris Cook from CNC Wildlife and Forestry Consultants. Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Our guest, Chris Cook, owner at CNC Wildlife and Forestry Consulting. And let's do this, too, before we go any further. Somebody wants to get in touch with you, come look at a piece of property, because you and I talked during the break. I mean, you can do the whole thing in the management plan, or, hey, I got this one specific project. You can come see them and help them.
Yeah, they can email me at Chris@CCWildlifeAndForestry.com. Chris@CCWildlifeAndForestry.com.
And check out his stuff on Facebook. You get good content there. And that's just your name on Facebook?
Yeah, I don't have one set up for the company yet or for my LLC. So you can just look for Chris Cook, and there's thousands of them. But I don't know how to tell you to find me. But
I'll send y'all, you know what, y'all can email me here at the station. I'll send you the right link to go.
But a lot of the stuff that Sean's referencing is things that I share posted by, a lot of it comes from Mississippi State, and they have a lot of great information coming out of the MSU Deer Lab, and then also some friends of mine that do a lot of Matt Brock and Jeremy Ferguson. They have a podcast, Southern U. They both have consulting companies, and they do post a lot of the stuff they're doing, and I like to promote what they're doing as well. If you can do that, then they can contact me, message me through Facebook or email me, either way.
Good stuff. You know what?
I just found you on Facebook. I got 13 friends.
Even Mike Ward can find you.
So how about that?
I mean, heck, it must be easy. You know, we're talking about this, and we just got a few minutes left, but one of the things you had on your Facebook page, and I remember reading the story back then, but I think things get my attention when they're counterintuitive. And we were talking about, you know, acorns falling, and you made a good point. I was talking about the acorns falling at my place, and you point out that probably is related to drought stress. That makes sense. I mean, we've been southwest quarter state. I don't know about the rest. We are terribly dry. Finally got a rain the other day, but terribly dry. Dropping. But we started talking about acorns, and like the idea of, I want to have a lot of acorns so I could hunt over them. Good for my turkeys, good for my deer hunting in the fall. So I need more trees to have more acres. And y'all are doing stuff where you're, it's a sin. You're cutting hardwoods out. Yeah. What are you doing?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of good science behind the releasing of trees that have the potential to be better acorn producers. And by releasing them, you know, you allow the crown to expand and they get, you have a lot better chance of them producing more acorns than trying to put fertilizer on trees that are crowded and maybe being suppressed by other oaks in the stand. So,
well, you're cutting out competition is what you're doing.
Yeah, and the thinning of those hardwood stands you mentioned, they're what you typically, when you're talking about managing stands like that for wildlife, you're typically removing all those trees that aren't traditional wildlife beneficial, or deer primarily beneficial trees. Like, you're taking out the sweet gums and the poplars and maybe hickories and leaving the oaks, the mass producers. By removing them, then you're also not only releasing those trees you're to potentially produce more mass that you put in sunlight on the ground, just like in a pine stand. So you're providing, I mentioned earlier about, you know, a lot of those hardwood stands, they just, or those oaks, they're producing a few acorns that, that deer eat on a couple months out of the year, and there's nothing left mm-hmm. for them in those stands. But by standing, you're also putting forbs and browse down there where deer can use on them, and turkeys and poults can utilize those areas throughout the year as well. So
yeah, it's not just a place
than just, there's not a lot more to it than just producing more acorns. So.
Well, yeah, and it's not just a place in the fall; it's a place to feed them year round. But I mean, if I remember right, don't have too long left, but obviously taking out those species that compete that aren't producing mast. But if I remember right, if you had, because I mean, the logic would be, if I got five oak trees, I'm producing five times the volume of acorns falling. But if I, in reality, if I take two or three of those out, I end up producing more total acorns than I did with five.
Yeah, you should. I mean, that's been, like I said, it's been.
Because you think, well, five times the number is going to be more, but in reality, because they're all kind of choking each other off, fewer produce more.
Well, that's just, you know, it's just like in your garden or anything mm-hmm. else. You can't crowd plants and expect them to produce bumper crops of fruit. So it's the same way with oak trees. They're,
well, same thing with pine trees.
They're not crowded or competing for resources, including sunlight. So.
Yeah, same thing with pine trees. I mean, you have to go in there and thin those out, too,
For pines, it makes sense to all of us.
Yeah.
But in hardwood, sometimes it'd be like a sit. You don't. What are you cutting those trees down? They're producing acorns.
Like Chris says, non-nut producing trees, a lot of them.
But I'm saying even if you had a tight stand that they're all producing, there are five oak trees are producing X amount of acorns. If you take two out, you could actually produce more with three than you did with five.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, if they were crowded in there,
it's just like, it makes sense. Like in the garden, you know, I plant okra thick and I go through as they're coming up and I start picking them out to get fewer stems.
Yeah.
And I actually produce more okra than if I just let the whole stand be thick.
You didn't tell me you had okra.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, still got okra. It's good, too. Yeah.
And all those trees in that stand, you know, some of them's going to have poorly formed crowns and other things that's going to keep them from being as good of acorn producers as others. So you're going to select the ones you want to leave, of course. You're not just going to randomly pull out trees if you're managing to try to produce a stand that's better for wildlife. You know, if you were managing it for timber production, you're going to have a different approach and different eye when you're going in to select which trees you want to pull out. So, you know, you got to consider what the objectives are. If it's wildlife, it's one thing, and timber production is another. So that all that's important to keep in mind.
I tell you what, I think these days, I mean, there might be some state numbers that prove me wrong, but these days I think the seesaw is leaning way more towards recreational and having game than it is timber production.
Yeah, there's still a really strong market for people looking to improve properties for wildlife and of course the timber markets in a lot of parts of the state's not anything like it used to be, it's hard to justify cutting some stuff just for timber sales.
That's truth. Chris, man, we appreciate it. I'm gonna have to get you back on before the rut. Okay. Can we make that deal?
Yeah, sure. Just you know how to get a hold of me.
I will.
Thank you, Chris.
There's Chris, and we'll do it again next week for FM Talk 106.5 Outdoors. Mm-hmm.